This is PCJ Radio International.
Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, Sichuan earthquake leaves towns in desperate circumstances. Bottlenecks in China quake zone frustrate survivors and rescuers. And old border quarrels resurface between India and China. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Figures for the death toll for the earthquake that hit Sichuan are still not known yet. Those who were injured in the earthquake are getting treatment, but only now have the disaster response teams been able to turn their attention to helping the tens of thousands of survivors who face life without homes, electricity, or running water. To find out more what the current situation is on the ground, we have this report from Stephen McDonald.
The residents of Baosheng-Xiang were being held back by the People's Armed Police. Ahead, troops were blasting to clear boulders blocking the road. Yet these people were anxious to get back and see what remained of their homes. Captain Xie Jianhua stood amongst the guards blocking access to the mountain dirt road on which large boulders had landed. He tried to ease tensions, telling the locals that his men were tired and frustrated too. We ask him how dangerous it really is. The main danger, he says, is that the mountain is high and unstable. We've had lots of aftershocks, 7 to 8 daily, all magnitude 5 or 6. Falling rocks have wounded our soldiers. This is very risky. The mountain communities here were at the epicentre of this earthquake, so naturally the hardest hit. As people wait to get access to Baosheng-Xiang, military police jog out the other way, carrying a man on a stretcher. Then the word comes through that the blasting has finished. The guards let people past, but as we walk next to an enormous sheer cliff, the land starts to give way again. Over the sound of falling rocks, everybody starts running, including the soldiers, so we do too. As stones fall from above, I hear them hitting the helmet I've been given to wear. We make it to the other side, where a large stone-busting machine is driving onto the bridge which crosses into Baosheng-Xiang. Its job is to break up a boulder as big as a car which has crashed down onto the bridge from the cliff above. We see no signs in this area of ongoing attempts to rescue people. The emphasis now is on helping survivors get on with their lives amidst the ruins of their homes. Zhang Mei is currently sleeping under the stars with her husband, 2 children and father-in-law. The 5 of them squash onto 1 double bed next to their collapsed house. We're not thinking about the future now, she tells us. And as she speaks, the ground starts to shake as another aftershock hits. She warns us that the bricks could fall down from a collapsed house next door. It's just not safe, she says. As we prepare to leave Zheng Mei's town, poor farmers are lining up with cane baskets on their backs so they can pick up their allocated ration of donated food and blankets. Then they walk back home to share these modest provisions with their families.
As rescue efforts continue, aftershocks continue to hit the area and have created landslides which hamper the rescue efforts. More than 200 people are confirmed dead, and thousands have been left injured. Some emergency medical teams have been parachuted into the more isolated hit villages, while 17,000 People Liberation Army troops and police have been sent to help. Japan and Australia have also offered assistance. The problem now is that rescuers are having problems reaching the survivors because of the crumbling of infrastructure due to the earthquakes. For more, we have this report from Karen Snowden.
The earth is never still for long in this steeply mountainous region of southwest China. 5 years ago, the catastrophic Wenchuan quake killed an estimated 90,000 injured hundreds of thousands and left millions homeless. Disaster preparedness training and the smaller buildings in the latest quake zone, just 200 kilometres away, seem to have reduced the toll. Emergency services are also better prepared, but this resident of the area says help was slow to arrive.
We're very scared, tired and very, very hungry. Up till now, the only help we've had from the government is two bottles of mineral water each, nothing else.
Rescuers have had to hike on foot to reach Lushan and Baoxing counties, southwest of Chengdu, the city near the epicentre of the 2008 earthquake. Hospitals and makeshift medical centres have been scrambling to provide assistance for the injured. Francis Marcus from the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says the difficult terrain and heavy traffic mean bottlenecks are preventing aid and equipment getting through quickly.
There is a bottleneck over which we have no control, really, meaning that, you know, we have lots of relief supplies on their way, but they are getting in, but they're not getting in as fast as we would want to distribute to the people in need.
Reports from Lushan say at least 2,000 aftershocks have kept people's nerves on edge. Plus, it's been raining and there's more rain on the way. Francis Marcus says isolated or cut-off communities, some with almost all houses destroyed, have now been reached.
Some of these communities have not been hit that badly in terms of loss of life, and we hope that the extent of loss of life will not go up dramatically from this point. But people are also facing the situation of being out of doors and needing shelter, needing the tents as fast as they can be got in, and also facing the worries of how they will reconstruct their homes and rebuild their livelihoods.
Presumably there were fewer multi-storey buildings as compared to the 2008 earthquake at that time. Of course, there was notorious criticism about the standard of buildings, particularly schools and hospitals. So we're not seeing the same level of destruction this time by any means of public buildings.
Right. They're much smaller areas than we saw in the earlier quake, and also less major population centres have been affected.
Are there enough medical teams at the moment to cope with the injured people?
Well, I think that one of the key problems at the moment has been getting the relief supplies in and the injured out. And there is also quite a delay, which we don't want to see, in getting medicines in. I think some of the hospitals were more proactive in getting their medical teams out to the disaster area quickly, having learned the lessons of the 2008 quake. So in that sense, and in many other ways, lots of lessons have been learned and lots of new capacity has been built.
What's most needed now to care for the survivors?
Well, people are still waiting for shelter in many cases. We're not getting the tents and the tarpaulins and medicines, baby supplies and radios and portable generators so that people can have power to help people be more comfortable. And hopefully after the aftershocks have subsided, then people will feel more calm and able to get on with their lives again in some sort of a way.
That was Karen Snowden reporting. A territorial row has erupted between New Delhi and Beijing on the Indian-Sino border. The disputed territory lies in a remote area of the Himalayas, where Chinese troops allegedly advanced into what New Delhi views as Indian land. The Chinese soldiers have set up camp and have refused to leave. We have this story from Emma Younger.
India's foreign ministry says it's asked Beijing to withdraw Chinese soldiers from what it says is Indian territory in eastern Kashmir. New Delhi claims the soldiers marched in on April 15 and pitched tents in the Depsang Valley in the Ladakh region. Syed Akbaruddin is a spokesman for India's foreign ministry.
We see this as a face-to-face situation between border personnel of the two sides due to differences on their alignment of the line of actual control.
The boundary between China and India has never been truly defined and is known as a line of actual control. The situation arose from several historical reasons, including confusion over where the border was demarcated during the colonial period. In October 1962, the countries fought a short border war, but with no resolution, soldiers continued to make incursions on each other's territory because of differing perceptions of where the border lies.
Now, the ongoing incident in the Dipsang area of the western sector of the India-China boundary is a localized event. This is a sector in which there are differing perceptions of the line of actual control. That is why we have, since 1996, been maintaining that there is a need for both sides to work together in clarifying and confirming the line of actual control.
In that spirit of working together, local Indian Army commanders have met with their Chinese counterparts at least twice since the soldiers set up camp. But they haven't been able to find a resolution, and China is maintaining it hasn't violated accords signed in the 1990s to maintain peace along the line of actual control. The Chinese Foreign Ministry had this to say.
The two sides have been in good contact, negotiating and coordinating on the border issue. We are willing to work together with India to properly solve issues that have been left over historically through peaceful talks in order to create good conditions for the healthy development of China-India relations.
Tension at the border is not unusual, with the Indian military recording as many as 400 incursions by 2012. Retired Commodore Uday Bhaskar is an Indian defence expert. He says this latest incident is being viewed seriously.
While troops would enter, maybe make a cup of tea or coffee or have a glass of rum or leave a few cigarette butts and just sort of leave some telltale signs, there was no attempt at setting up anything like a semi-permanent presence. This time around, the Indians are concerned because Chinese troops have set up some tents. There is talk about Chinese helicopters also overflying. And all this is a few notches above the median that we normally associate with these quote-unquote accepted incursions.
In recent years, ties between the Asian giants have strengthened. A visit by Chinese Premier Li Keqiang to New Delhi next month is part of those ongoing efforts. Commodore Bhaskar says this latest incident is likely to impact on talks but won't damage relations.
I do not think it would be a prudent step on the part of China when they still have to address their differences with Japan and with ASEAN to open a whole new front with India. When this has been stable for more than two decades, it's not as if either side is trying to stake a new kind of claim. There is a status quo.
Commodore Bhaskar says India is not the only country concerned by the latest flare-up of this historic dispute.
While there is a Chinese rhetoric in public about the peaceful rise of China, I think every neighbour of China would be monitoring this very carefully to see the degree to which China matches word with deed.
After 50 years of an ill-defined border, Commodore Bhaskar says it's time for some clarity.
The more you allow this to fester, to say that you don't have an agreed border, the probability of such instances flaring up again is quite high. And this time we have a new sort of dimension, which is that of transparency and the media focus, which in a way adds to creeping nationalism on both sides.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. You can hear us through a wide variety of partner stations around the world, including the internet at our website, which is pcjmedia.com/FAP. You can also listen to us from a very interesting phone app called Stitcher. Here's Bob Zanotti to tell us more.
You can hear PCJ Radio while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news, talk, and entertainment mobile app available for your smartphone. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher from the App Store. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter PCJ to get automatically entered to win $100. For more information, go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on the Stitcher logo on the right menu. PCJ Radio on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio.
A former Fiji Human Rights Commissioner, Shamima Ali, says she doesn't want to believe there's an official investigation into a video showing security forces beating two men. The video appeared on the internet more than a month and a half ago, and initially the Fijian police said they were concerned about it and would launch an investigation. But unfortunately, this has not happened. Bruce Hill next speaks to Shamina Ali about the situation.
There is no evidence whatsoever of any investigation being underway. When that has been queried on Radio Talkback show with the commander, his response has been, what would you do if somebody enters your house and tries to rob you and kill you? Aren't you going to act in self-defense and so on? So, you know, I just waylays people in that manner. That's a response, apart from that very sinister comment that he will stand by his men. Really, we haven't seen anything whatsoever, any evidence that any investigation is being carried out.
When this torture video surfaced, it was condemned not just in Fiji but around the world. The United Nations condemned it. The parliaments of Australia and New Zealand had a vote to condemn it. When this international pressure is brought to bear, couldn't that, in a sense, cause the Fiji interim government to simply raise the drawbridge and simply not engage and simply say, you guys are just being totally unfair, and it could actually have a negative effect on a concern for human rights in Fiji?
No, I don't believe, you know, that Fiji is in a position to do that. It's a member of the UN. It belongs to the international community. It cannot ignore. It can act in that manner, but I'm sure something is hitting home. It has to adhere to universal standards of human rights and humanitarian law, as Amnesty International said. So that holds no water with me, what they do. What is also significant is the fact that the draft constitution, that we are very concerned about the protection of civil and political rights, because there are significant derogations, particularly in the right to life. And it actually mentions the fact that these derogations will effectively legitimize the killing of escaped and escaping prisoners and persons participating in riots and insurrection. Given that this is a military regime, that is very, very significant for human rights and for prisoners or anyone who dares to go against this regime. So it's actually now in the draft constitution, and questions around that have been asked and they have been brushed aside.
Well, the Fiji police said when this torture video surfaced that they were very concerned and they would launch an immediate investigation. We've been asking the Fiji government and the police about this investigation, or if they could confirm or deny that there is an investigation, and all we got from a senior police officer was no comment and absolutely nothing from the actual government itself. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. Not at all, because that's the way things go. Once Bainimarama has spoken and has uttered those words that he's going to stand by his men or women or whatever, no one will dare carry out an investigation. No independent investigation will be carried out. We don't believe that the police force acts independently of government. It is not the professional force that we know. It is highly militarized. It has got a military commander at the head of it. So there is no way they will dare to, even though professionally many police officers know that that should be done, corrections officers would know that that should be done. There needs to be, you know, that is the process, you know, in if we're talking about good governance and so on. They will dare not do it once those words have been uttered by the commander.
But does this really concern people in Fiji? Because I saw a lot of the comments on social media. People were quite shocked by the video, but a lot of people were saying, yeah, but these were bad guys. They kind of got what was coming to them. Does this really concern Fiji citizens as much as it does the rest of the world?
It does concern people who care for human rights, who know what can happen, but there are some people who actually don't understand what human rights is about. They do not understand the legal processes, the rule of law, and things like that. But in conversations that we have had, you know, people are concerned that that investigation has not taken place. And, you know, then also, you know, what about the past incidents? This is something that was so visible. But also the escaped prisoners, the five of them who were so badly tortured and so on. One had his leg amputated and it was said that he had diabetes and things like that. You know, so those also have been swept under the carpet. So for the human community and many other upstanding people in this country, it is a concern.
Assuming, for the sake of argument, that there is no investigation, we've found no evidence that there is one, what, if anything, can people in Fiji do about that?
Well, at this point in time, no one can do anything apart from raise our concerns, you know, and also reflect it in this draft constitution. But definitely we cannot use the media, because the media will not publish anything that will even slightly seem critical of the regime. I have raised it with the Commonwealth Contact Group that was here in the country last week, and also with the Forum Ministerial Contact Group that I particularly raised that issue, that those things need to be questioned over those things and investigations and so on. But I did not get any response back.
An Indonesian police chief has faced the country's most powerful corruption court, accused of money laundering. Inspector General Diko Salulo is accused of amassing more than $50 million in suspicious wealth. There are media reports that he bought properties in Australia and Singapore, and prosecutors have focused on more than 40 properties he originally paid cash for in Indonesia. We have this story from George Roberts in Jakarta.
In a flutter of camera flashes, Inspector General Joko Susilo pushed through the media scrum to face a more ominous opponent. Prosecutors allege he bought nearly 40 properties in Indonesia under various names, with millions of dollars gained from corruption and money laundering. Junifer Giersung is Joko's lawyer.
About the use of money laundering, under the anti-money laundering law, the facts they mentioned are about the assets that Mr. Joko acquired or got before 2011.
He argues it all happened before the Corruption Commission, or KPK, was established. Mr. Giersung is questioning the Commission's power to apply laws and investigate events that predate it.
Today we say that there's no rights for the KPK to use that law because KPK was not established in 2002 or 2003. Whether it is KPK's mistake or it is deliberate with some purpose, as a procedure, it's incorrect.
It's an attempt to discredit the court. The police have long argued they hold the jurisdiction over the case. But as a corruption expert, Ocha Madril from the Gajah Mada University explains, there are problems with the police investigating a police general.
So it's difficult to imagine that this investigation will go properly, for example. There will be a conflict of interest. Maybe there might be interference from the high rank of the officers. So that's why I think it's better to give this case to the KPK.
Indonesian traffic police have a reputation for taking bribes, and Danang Widioko from Indonesian Corruption Watch says it's so systematic that the police force operates like a pyramid scheme.
Because the corruption is structurally embedded in the structure of the police, from the low rank police officer, from the police in the street, until the high rank, the general of the police.
The corruption court has heard that Inspector General Joko Susilo allegedly amassed a combined wealth of $57 million, as well as properties, businesses and cars in Indonesia. There are reports he bought places in Australia and Singapore too. Ocha Madril again.
We know a lot of data that say that most of the police, the high rank of police officers, have a suspicious bank account. And this data coming from the Financial Transaction Reports and Analysis Center, we can call it a kind of financial intelligence unit of Indonesia.
It'll be months before there's a verdict in Joko Susilo's case. The pile of written evidence against him alone is about 1.7 metres high. Whatever the result, it's put the police in the spotlight, and they don't like being investigated.
And finally on the program, we go to Tonga. The United Nations Development Fund has signed an agreement with the Tongan government to promote democracy and good governance within the country. The $3.8 billion US dollar program is funded by Australia's international aid agency, AusAid. Geraldine Coutts from Radio Australia speaks next to Brett Adlam, Australia's High Commissioner to Tonga.
Thanks very much. Three components. We've been targeted in three key areas, Geraldine. And they will be support to Parliament and the Parliament of Tonga and its parliamentary processes and parliamentarians also. So as part of that capacity building effort that is going on in other parts of the region through the UNDP and that we're supporting too. So we're focused on strengthening the role of Parliament, the committees process, parliamentary committees process, public hearings, committee reporting, for instance, and parliamentary reporting, briefing parliamentarians on legislation, on things like Millennium Development Goals and their role in the parliamentary process. Also strengthening public advocacy and outreach and civic education for Parliament in reaching out to the community and promoting community education and awareness. There's also a gender component, Geraldine, which will focus on practice parliaments for women and also women and youth and young people, but also we'll look to provide training for potential or prospective women candidates who are interested in entering Tongan politics and Tongan parliament. Then there's also work that will be done with the community, with the civil society organisations and a civic education program. There'll be a focus on building mechanisms for stronger consultation and effective consultation between Parliament and the civil society organisations in Tonga. But then also an important component is actually the continuation of the Australian Electoral Commission's work with and support for the Tongan Electoral Commission. And that goes to the conduct of elections, that goes to policy advice and electoral support, including during the actual elections themselves, as there are local elections coming up next month in May, and then, of course, with the national elections next year. That is, it's all part of our ongoing support for Tonga's efforts to continue to develop its governance arrangements, Geraldine.
Well, of course, in terms of the good governance process and democracy, it's very much a transition period for Tonga, having changed their electoral process and commoners now being elected to the parliament. So you're viewing this in part, as I hear in the comprehensive explanation of where this money's going, is to provide education and a learning experience for new parliamentarians and indeed the community to know what democracy can be.
That's absolutely right, Geraldine. I think we recognise that, that an important part of any governance system and of any parliamentary and political process is the engagement of the general public. It is the engagement of civil society and the way that they can also inform the decision-making process. So that will be important elements of this program delivered by the UNDP. Precisely as you say, I think, and I was reminded of this the other day at the launch itself, Geraldine, and I'm sure you won't mind me paraphrasing him, but the Finance Minister at the launch, the Honourable Luciani Akoro, actually said at the time that we should remember Tonga is, it's a very old country, of course, with a very long history, but it's also a very, very young country or a new country in terms of the current governance arrangements, the new governance arrangements. So we're talking about a system that is 3 years old. So I think our support recognises what has been achieved in a very short time by the Kingdom of Tonga and the Government of Tonga and the Parliament. And this is an opportunity to build on the achievements that have been made and to continue the process of strengthening decision-making and governance arrangements in Tonga with the full support of the Government of Tonga.
All right. Mr. Eldham, it's not a good line. We're not going to keep you much longer, but just very briefly, it is Anzac Day today, and you're at an Anzac breakfast as we speak.
That's absolutely right, Geraldine. I've just excused myself from a traditional gunfire breakfast at the residence. It is a lovely occasion. I think I might claim it as the first Anzac Day dinner service in the world, as close as we are to the dateline. It was a lovely service, and we were privileged to have His Majesty the King of Tonga attend and a number of very senior figures from government, from parliament and from the community, as well, of course, all of our fellow Australians and New Zealanders. So we're now enjoying our Anzac Day breakfast.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. If you want to download this program and listen to past editions, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Pallon wishing you well, hoping you join us again in 7 days' time. Take care, everyone, and have a good weekend.